The Second Husband. For it is not an open enemy that hath done me this dishonour, for then I could have borne it. Neither was it mine adversary that did magnify himself against me, for then peradventure I would have hid myself from him. But it was thou, my companion, my guide, and mine own familiar friend. From Psalm 55, copied and kept by Agatha Christie. From then on, it was as though a knife fell, cutting my life into two halves. From Endless Night by Agatha Christie. From this point, the deepest mystery was Agatha herself. She had grown up at last, and with adulthood came concealment. A new self worn like protective colouring. She had lived in the world of her dreams, and had been the heroine of her life and books for more than 30 years. Now she merely dreamed her dreams. Youth and beauty had gone, as had love and contentment. In their place came something else. The life of a writer. In the dark year of 1928, Agatha wrote her first Mary Westmacott novel, Giant's Bread. The protagonist, Vernon Dayer, serves in the war and is reported killed. A mistake has been made, but believing the news, Vernon's wife remarries. It is when he reads the notice of this wedding that Vernon tries to kill himself in earnest. He walks out into the road and is hit by a lorry. When he recovers from his injuries, he has become a man called George Green, as whom he is completely happy. Later, he is brought back to the old self he wanted to escape. It's been rather hell, getting back, remembering things. All such beastly things, all the things that, really, I didn't want to face. He thinks vaguely that life as Vernon Dare might be the same as it was before he went away. But his wife no longer wants him, and eventually he is free of emotional ties. There is nothing now to come between him and his work. Vernon realizes that his calling is that of a musician, an artist, and that the life he has lived, however real and absorbing, is nothing but material. That was what it meant to be a creator. Having lost his old identity, having travelled through the happy limbo period as George Green, he has finally come to the place where he is supposed to be. Similarly, Henrietta Savernaik, in The Hollow, is an artist, a sculptress, who cannot help but experience life at one remove. When her lover is murdered, she turns her deepest feelings into an alabaster work entitled Sorrow. I cannot love, I cannot mourn, not with the whole of me. She asks what the word integrity means, wondering if she herself can possibly possess such a quality. She considers the quotation from Peer Gynt that haunted Agatha all her life. Where am I myself? The whole man, the true man. Where am I with God's mark upon my brow? This is what Agatha had become. A Vernon, a Henrietta. The dream period spent as Mrs. Neal rearranged her personality in a fundamental way, and through the dark years of 1927 and 1928, she became the person she would not otherwise have been. She became a writer. Her dreams became her work, and her work became everything. She wrote too much, and too compulsively, for anyone to doubt that this is where the real Agatha now lived. It was the way to survive the great rupture of 1926, either that or go under. The life she had had before no longer existed, so she became an onlooker, an outsider. It was not what she had wanted, but it was the right thing. As her friend A.L. Rouse wrote, "The wound left by that nightmare year was so deep, it left traces all through her work. It also made her the great woman she became." Why else did she begin to write Giant's Bread if not as a somber celebration of a new beginning? Without the burden of normal female expectations, she found herself free. There was no longer an obligation to be a certain kind of woman, slim, pleasing, feminine. She could absent herself from these restraints. She could formulate a persona and wear it like a suit of armor, present it to the world in place of herself, and inside she could be whatever she chose. This was the freedom of the creator. She had lost everything and found everything, because everything was material. As Agatha Christie, she could write as much as her facility would allow, and from the end of the decade, the books poured forth. 17 full-length novels between 1930 and 1939, shaped with the geometrical perfection she had first shown in The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. The murderer who pretends to be the victim, the murderer who pretends to be a serial killer, the murderer who is the investigating policeman, the cast of suspects who are all innocent, the cast of suspects who are all guilty. Magnificent, bold ideas that did not merely reinvigorate detective fiction, but redesigned it as a gleaming hall of bright new mirrors. So impregnable was the construct that although the world of books was Agatha's to create, she never had to reveal anything of herself. That never again. Agatha Christie wrote the books, the clever, controlled, sensible woman who knew all about human emotion, but who dealt with it every time and kept chaos at bay. Agatha herself was Mary Westmacott, the sensitive, secret creature who had been born of the drifting ghost of Harrogate, and who could never have existed without the strange freedom that came from using another woman's name. Mary Westmacott wrote about love and its mysteries. She wrote about Archie Christie. He was her primary inspiration. In Giant's Bread, she pondered the idea of love at first sight, its absurdity and its peculiar power. Vernon is in love with his wife Nell because he always sees her as she first appeared to him, magical and moonlit. She is also weak-natured, but this does not stop Vernon loving her. He is unable to separate the force of his emotions from the person towards whom they are directed. Similarly with Agatha and Archie. She wrote about their marriage in her second Westmacott unfinished portrait, and her conclusion is simple. Whether or not her husband, Dermot, is worthy of her love, that love exists. In order to keep it alive for herself, she should have recognized the truth about Dermot. I loved Dermot, and I didn't keep him. I ought to have seen what he liked and wanted and been that. I ought to have known and been on my guard and not been so cocksure and pleased with myself. If a thing matters to you more than anything in life, you've got to be clever about it. I wasn't clever about it. She had been brought up to believe that marriage mattered more than anything to a woman, and that a man had to be held by a wife. Her grandmother, her mother, they had both told her so. Yet she had failed to keep her husband. Her flight to Harrogate, which had been her last desperate throw of the dice, had ensured that he would never return. Every day she had spent as Mrs. Neal had banged another nail into the coffin of her marriage. This was the knowledge she now had to live with, that by her own actions she had brought about these terrible consequences. This was what she went through in 1927 and 1928, all the time turning her agony into material, all the time wishing that she simply had her husband back. Of course, she could say to herself that Archie would have left anyway in the end, and possibly this was true. But there would always be the doubt that, if she had behaved differently, he might have stayed. Throughout the bleak months, Agatha had to bear public opprobrium and mockery. These were bad enough in themselves. Worse, though, was that this public attention, which it was widely believed she had sought, was the thing she had least wanted, the thing that had destroyed her private, precious world. It was a ghastly, shaming irony. She did not know what Archie thought, how much he blamed her for the wreckage of his own life, but obviously she feared the worst. This, then, was another irony, that the guilty party in all of this was now causing Agatha to feel guilt on his behalf. A small part of her still hoped faintly that he might come back. She had moved to a flat in Chelsea with Rosalind and Carlo. Archie was living at Stiles while trying to sell it, and the thought of him in the house, a hated place, but it had been theirs, must have taunted her. It's all the little shared intimacies of life that hold you so with a husband, and tear you to pieces when you part. She wrote an unfinished portrait. She knew, really, that even if he did come back, they could never be happy again. She was not the kind of woman, wry, adult, realistic to the point of cynicism, to live with a man who longed to be elsewhere. Her kind brothers-in-law, James Watts and Campbell Christie, both helped her to understand this. But later in 1927 she saw Archie again, a polite and dreadful meeting at which we talked of ordinary things, and she asked one last time if he might not be persuaded to stay, for Rosalind's sake. "I said once again that he knew how fond of him she was," wrote Agatha in her autobiography, "and how much she had been puzzled by his absence." The answer was no. He still loved Nancy, and Nancy, despite having been away for the last 10 months, still loved him. Of course, he owed a debt to Nancy, albeit far smaller than the one he owed his wife, for the damage to her reputation. Being the man he was, decisive and sudden and unwilling to admit mistakes, he was going to stick with the woman who had caused all this in the first place. To have said to Agatha, "Yes, I was wrong, yes, I should stay with you," would have been impossible. So Agatha accepted it was over. She never saw Archie again, although she kept his love letters and photographs. She went to court on the 20th of April 1928, listened to the fake evidence of adultery with an unknown party in the Grosvenor Hotel, and in October was granted her divorce. 2 weeks later, Archie married Nancy. After her divorce, Agatha never again took communion in church. Always she felt shame and guilt, especially towards her daughter, for having given in to Archie's demands for a divorce. "I don't even know why I did give in," she wrote in unfinished portrait. "Because I was tired and wanted peace, or because I became convinced it was the only thing to be done? Or because, after all, I wanted to give in to Dermot? I think sometimes it was the last. That's why, ever since, I felt guilty when Judy looked at me. In the end, you see, I betrayed Judy for Dermot." Archie's second marriage lasted until Nancy died of cancer in 1958. Agatha wrote to Archie to condole with him, and he wrote back thanking her for giving him 30 years of happiness with Nancy. An apparently benign exchange which, nonetheless, hums with undercurrents. Was Agatha really so altruistic, or was a small part of her reminding Archie of the luxurious, splendid life he could have had with her? And was Archie's reply entirely tactful, in the light of the suffering that his love for Nancy had caused Agatha? The marriage of Archie and Nancy, whose son was born in 1930, must have been shadowed with memories. Agatha was not a person they could escape. Her fame grew, her name was constantly in the newspapers, her books were everywhere. How odd for the Christies to see the ABC murders, say, in the window of the local bookshop, and to know that its celebrated author had been willing to go to such lengths on their account. At home, Agatha's name was not mentioned, nor were the events of 1926. Indeed, Archie's son knew almost nothing about them until he reached maturity. Like Agatha herself, these were people who believed in the value of concealment and reticence. Whatever either Archie or Nancy thought or felt about the strange beginnings of their relationship, they pushed it aside and dealt with the realities. It is generally agreed that their marriage was a success. Nancy, it was said, was fun and full of life. I'm sure theirs was a happy marriage because she was such a happy woman. Yet Agatha, too, had had a vast capacity for joy, and her zest for life had ended by irritating Archie greatly. "He was not a sociable animal," said his son, "although my mother was." So Nancy was not exactly Archie's soulmate any more than Agatha had been, and he fell for her in the same abrupt way that he had fallen for Agatha. The difference, of course, was that while Agatha had been beautiful, Nancy was beautiful still, and she was a wife in the way that Archie craved. She did not have that quality of obtuseness which Agatha had displayed towards her husband, and which seemed unjustly like selfishness. After their separation, the lives of Archie and Agatha diverged so completely that it is hard to believe they ever thought they would grow old together. Archie did well in the city and acquired several directorships, including one in the Rank organization. Although in a 1958 letter to Rosalind, he admitted that, "Twice I have been down to zero, and that may happen again." He left upwards of £90,000 gross when he died in 1962. Before the Second World War, he had a home in London's Smart Avenue Road, and later acquired a house in Godalming, which apparently had no taste. By that time, he had given up golf. He lived quietly. "He was a good chap," said Agatha's perceptive son-in-law, Anthony Hicks, who met Archie with Rosalind on a few occasions. "Rosalind didn't want to meet Nancy, so I didn't meet her very often. She was quite dull, and Archie became duller." Meanwhile, Agatha glittered and shone and became one of the most famous women in the world. She bought houses with abandon, living as she chose in Kensington, South Kensington, Oxfordshire, or Devon. She travelled to glamorous faraway lands. She married again, a man of intellect who had no fear of her brilliant, fertile mind, but had the sense instead to revel in the fruits of its labours. She learned a different way of life. Archie weathered the shame of the police investigation, the embarrassment of the scandal, the near total rupture with Rosalind. He acquired the life with Nancy that he had craved throughout 1926. The pain of getting rid of his wife had, it seemed, been worthwhile. But some years later, he had a breakdown of his own, requiring hospital treatment of a serious nature, from which he recovered well. Like his mother and brother, he had always been fragile, although his self-control was remarkable. Ever blunt in his opinions, A.L. Rouse had little doubt that Archie had done the wrong thing in leaving Agatha, and that he must have known it. Poor Mr. Christie, what a story he would make, looking at it from his point of view. What a mistake he made. A friend of Agatha's told Rouse that Archie had had reason to regret his conduct since. In other words, that he knew he should have stuck with his first wife. This is speculation, of course, but it is the sort of question that Agatha would repeatedly ask, whether Archie might not have been happier in the end had he stayed, and whether she herself would have been happier had she lived until death with her own familiar friend, had the lifelong compensations for his absence been unnecessary. What did Roddy know of Mary Gerard? Nothing. Less than nothing. It was the old story, nature's hoary old joke. Didn't Roddy himself, really, want to be free of it? So wrote Agatha in Sad Cypress, and indeed when Mary Gerard dies, Roddy emerges from her spell with the easy bewilderment of a man waking out of a dream. Of Eleanor Carlyle, the girl who loves Roddy so deeply, it is said, "She'll forgive him the Mary Gerard business. It was only a wild infatuation on his part, anyway." But Hercule Poirot speaks with the wisdom of his creator and says, "It goes deeper than that. There is sometimes a deep chasm between the past and the future. When one has walked in the valley of the shadow of death and come out of it into the sunshine, then, mon cher, it is a new life that begins. The past will not serve." In 1927, Agatha did not understand this yet, or understood it only in theory. Her life on the surface was as grey and dreary as a prison exercise yard, her mind prey to a daily succession of torments. She lived in London, hating it. But to hate was easier than to be at Ashfield, where she would remember love. Madge had suggested she live quietly in Devon, but, as she wrote in her autobiography, "Something that reminds you of a happy day or a happy thing, that's the thing that almost breaks you in two." She thought on the whole that she would prefer to be dead, but those who had failed to kill themselves didn't do it again. So she wrote in Towards Zero. She could not bear her notoriety, the fact that every time she went out or gave her name, she was waiting for a reaction. Recognition, curiosity, contempt. She was an acutely sensitive creature whose wrenching griefs had been exposed to national ridicule. She had been condemned for something she had not done. In 1929, she wrote in the Sunday Chronicle about the Croydon murders, as they were known, in which three members of the same family were poisoned. The murderer clearly came from within the family circle, but the case was, and remains, unsolved. It always fascinated Agatha, not least because it is a case where the innocent suffer most horribly for sins they have never committed. They live in a haze of publicity. Acquaintance and friends look at them curiously. There are continually autograph hunters, curious idle crowds. Any decent, happy private life is made impossible for them. The idea in this article would later be written into one of her best detective novels, Ordeal by Innocence. She knew, of course, that Rosalind was bewildered and upset. When Agatha's own mother had been devastated by the death of her husband, she had been told to live for her children. But this was not Agatha's way. "The bright spot in my life was Rosalind," she wrote in her autobiography. In fact, it was not quite that simple. She was too much of a child herself. She still missed her mother too much, and she was torn by her complex feelings towards her daughter. She never said anything, but I thought that secretly she blamed me for the loss of her father, she wrote in Unfinished Portrait. I failed her. The guilt that Agatha felt made her deeply uncomfortable. She was sorry for her daughter, but not always sympathetic, particularly as Rosalind remained so determinedly keen to see Archie. This was not a modern divorce, so Archie did not have access. He did not turn up at Agatha's door to take his daughter off for weekends. Rosalind did not meet Nancy. She did not even meet her half-brother until Archie's funeral. Archie, for his part, never met Rosalind's son. The lives of Rosalind's parents became entirely separate, which would nowadays seem odd. But it is hard to imagine how Agatha would have coped with Archie's constant presence in her life. For Archie, too, it would have been quite impossible. As an adult, Rosalind was discreet about her meetings with Archie, the boxes of whiskey he sent her at Christmas. "I certainly always saw my father myself. We were very fond of each other," she wrote in a letter not long before she died. She was pragmatic enough to accept what he had done, and loyal enough to proclaim her affection. "I hate the image of him as someone cold and unfeeling," she said. And as a child, she missed him badly. She had been uprooted from Sunningdale, the big house, the proper family, and moved to a London flat full of women, around which her mother drooped like a dying bird. Although barely nine, she was glad to go to the Caledonia boarding school in Bexhill, where both her parents could visit her. When Agatha was away, as increasingly she would be, Carlo or Madge would go in her stead. The letters that Rosalind sent home to her mother were cool, funny, and occasionally barbed. "Thank you very much for the letter you sent me, although it was very short. Rosemary Lever was sick all over the passage the other day. She is going out today. Her mother came to church to take her out. She looked rather nice. And I'm getting a bit tired of writing to you, so I will now write a short letter to Daddy. And after Agatha's second marriage, don't be late for sports, will you? Don't come in your black and white dress, come in an ordinary dress. Who are you bringing to the sports this year? I would rather you brought only Carlo." This was utterly remote from the relationship that Agatha had had with Clara, all that darling mummy and pigeony pumpkin. Rosalind had never been easy for her mother to deal with. Something about this marvellous, bright, sharp-edged child seems to have shriveled Agatha's maternal impulse in the bud, and the break with Archie ensured it would never flower. Always there would be tension, a kind of tough, joshing bonhomie between the two that precluded simple affection. "I don't know whether she loves me or doesn't love me," wrote Agatha in Unfinished Portrait. "The kind of person I am is no good to the kind of person she is. I love her, just as I love Dermot, but I don't understand her." In fact, there was love on both sides, and a neediness that for some reason neither could show. When Agatha was trying to write again, on a holiday to the Canary Islands in February 1928, she was nearly driven mad when her daughter would not leave her alone. Had Peter the dog been standing there, Agatha would have melted. So she did subsequently with her grandson. With her daughter, though, it was different. Always there was a barrier, the gulf. Agatha sensed that she had let Rosalind down, but more obscurely, she felt that Rosalind had contributed to the death of her marriage. She believed that a child came between a man and a woman, and she had no compunction about writing this in both Unfinished Portrait and A Daughter's a Daughter. So Rosalind knew her mother's feelings, and it was said, felt in some way responsible for the divorce. There was guilt on both sides. There was resentment of this guilt. And there was the irreductible fact that Agatha had been prepared to abandon Rosalind when she disappeared in 1926. Hardly surprising that both mother and daughter should have taken refuge in the amnesia theory, although Agatha's books told Rosalind a good deal that was otherwise left unsaid. "I have always thought how singularly lucky you were to have her for a mother, and I have no doubt at all that you share this opinion," wrote a family friend to Rosalind after Agatha's death. Her reply would have been exemplary. Her feelings were a good deal more complicated. The book that Agatha had been writing on her 1928 holiday was The Mystery of the Blue Train. The year before, she had finished cobbling together some Poirot short stories previously printed in a sketch into a book entitled The Big Four. In her autobiography, Agatha emphasized how difficult it had been to finish these two books, although what she did not say was that she had actually been halfway through both at the time of her disappearance. Nor was The Blue Train in need of much original thought, as, like The Big Four, it was derived from a short story, The Plymouth Express. The difficulty was that she had never before had to write when she did not want to. Writing had always been a happy activity. It had been hard work, but the work had been her choice. Now she had to write. She was not quite as destitute as her autobiography implies. She had been left something in the region of £13,000 by her mother, and although she had sunk all her capital into styles, the house was on the market. A flat in Chelsea, a home in Devon, a child at boarding school and a personal secretary does not sound like penury. But when Agatha wrote about her financial fears, "I had no money coming in from anywhere," what she was really describing was her state of mind. She was utterly panic-stricken about the future. Like most women who have been protected all their lives, looked after by their family, then their husband, and who suddenly find themselves completely alone, Agatha was frightened. Who would look after her now? Even if writing The Mystery of the Blue Train seemed like the most hideous job in the world, which it did, she had to do it. Simple as that. In her autobiography, she described the transition in straightforward terms. She had been an amateur. She was now a professional. But what had happened was far more subtle and profound. There was a fundamental difference in the way she engaged with her work. And even in Blue Train, which she professed to detest, this came across. She was writing it not just because she had to for money, but because she had to for herself. Some of the book is indeed Workaday Christie, but she created in it a character called Catherine Gray, and this calm, observant, attractive woman was balm to her shattered spirit. Catherine is alone in the world, albeit with money, and is described as being in the autumn of her years, a situation terrifying to her creator, but which Catherine handles with a quiet, humorous assurance that Agatha must have longed to possess. It soothed her to dream it into life. "Don't think you'll get married, my dear, because you won't," says an old lady friend before Catherine leaves for the Riviera. "You're not the kind to attract the men, and besides, you're getting on. How old are you?"
33, Catherine told her.
"Well," remarked Miss Viner doubtfully, "that's not so very bad. You've lost your first freshness, of course."
"I'm afraid so," said Catherine,
much entertained. On the blue train, Catherine dines with a fellow traveller, Ruth Kettering, who is coming to the end of a bad marriage. "You may have a hankering after the fellow still. Cut it out," her father says to her, urging divorce as the only possible solution. "I might find ways of whistling Derek back to you, but it would all come to the same in the end." Ruth intends to meet a lover in Nice and asks Catherine whether she should go ahead. "It seems to me an awfully silly thing that you are going to do," is the unarguable reply. "I think you realize that yourself." Throughout much of this book, Agatha is talking to herself, reassuring herself about the divorce, allowing the integrity of her heroine to console her. Catherine might have hankered after Archie still, but her instinctive sense of self would have come to her rescue, and she would not have longed for what could not be. She would have faced facts. Hercule Poirot, too, admires Catherine Gray, and by allowing a friendship to develop between the two, Agatha gave a new quality to her detective, hitherto a mere charismatic assemblage of moustaches and bombast. On the blue train, Poirot is wise as well as clever. His eyes penetrate emotion as well as facts. He has in his way a tendresse for Catherine, and this too was oddly comforting to his tired and sad creator. "Well, mademoiselle, how goes it?" She looked at his twinkling eyes and was confirmed in her first impression that there was something very attractive about Monsieur Hercule Poirot. Later, Poirot was talking to the daughter of one of his contacts. They are standing beside a bridge, and a girl says to him that it is a favorite spot for suicides.
"So it is said. Men are foolish, are they not, mademoiselle? To eat, to drink, to breathe the good air. It is a very pleasant thing, mademoiselle. One is foolish to leave all that simply because one has no money, or because the heart aches. L'amour, it causes many fatalities, does it not?"
This was the attitude that Agatha yearned for. Again, there was consolation in writing it into life. But perhaps the greatest solace of all was the blue train itself. Murder scene it may have been, yet it bloomed in Agatha's mind as a symbol of order and escape. She had always wanted to travel. However much she had loved Archie, she had known in her heart that they were very different people, that while he moved with apparent contentment between Sunningdale and Waterloo and the city, day in, day out, she craved the sight of the unknown. They'd go on and on and on, probably at Dalton Heath or somewhere like it. She'd never see things, far away things, India, China, Japan, the wilds of Baluchistan, Persia, where the names were like music, Isfahan, Tehran, Shiraz. She had longed for freedom and for love, and she was beginning to learn that the two rarely went together. Now she had exchanged one for the other, and she had that other thing, writing. She would write her books, including the special secret one, Giant's Bread, which was all about the things that fascinated and perplexed her, and she would travel. Carlo and Madge would visit Rosalind at school, and she, Agatha, would go to the West Indies. She booked her tickets, excited at the prospect of spending the winter of 1928 in the sun. Then came a push from fate. A day or two before she was to leave, she went to a dinner party in London and sat next to a man just back from Baghdad. "Oh," she said, "that was somewhere she had always dreamed of visiting." He seemed unsurprised and was full of information. "You could get there," he told her, "by train, the Orient Express." Oh, how wonderful that sounded. You could see the archaeological dig at Ur, which was then all over the Illustrated London News. Its leader, Leonard Woolley, was making spectacular claims to have found the site of the biblical flood. "Oh, yes," said the man, "you should certainly go to Iraq sometime." The next day, Agatha went to Cook's and changed her tickets. She would take the Orient Express to Stamboul, then go on to Damascus in Syria, and finally to Baghdad. Carlo expressed concerns. The East, a woman, unaccompanied? But for the first time in more than 2 years, Agatha felt alive again. She would travel alone to new worlds. She would dare. Her course was set. One of my pet theories, quite unrealizable, of course, that's the pleasant part about theories, is that everybody should spend 1 month a year in the middle of a desert, with enough to eat and drink, and nothing, absolutely nothing to do, you'd have at last a fairly good chance to make acquaintance with yourself. Thus speaks Laura Whitstable in A Daughter's a Daughter. Nothing, she says, is more important than that people should know themselves. A man should have knowledge of himself and belief in God. Yet this was an extraordinarily hard thing to achieve, as Agatha herself now recognized. And what did it mean? In early 1927, she had gone, at her sister's suggestion, to a psychiatrist in Harley Street. Did she believe that this would help in any way? As much as anything, she went to maintain the fiction that she had lost her memory and needed to recover it. In other words, she was lying about herself to find out the truth about herself. According to Agatha's Daily Mail interview in 1928, she had been told that for the health of my mind, there should be no hiatus of any kind in my recollections. That is why I can now recall at the same time my existence as Mrs. Christie and as Mrs. Neal. This, of course, was a kind of nonsense. Agatha may well have duped her doctors. She was quite clever enough to do that, to fake confusion like Jane Finn in The Secret Adversary. Yet at the same time, being forced to talk, to remember, was genuinely painful. Vernon was listening, trying to understand what the doctor was saying to him. He looked across the table at him. A tall, thin man, with eyes that seemed to see right into the center of you, and to read there things that you didn't even know about yourself. And he made you see all the things you didn't want to see, made you bring things up out of the depths. He was saying, "Now that you have remembered, tell me again exactly how you saw the announcement of your wife's marriage." Vernon cried out, "Must we go over it again and again? It was all so horrible. I don't want to think of it any more." Agatha was interested in psychiatry. She was interested in almost everything. But her own means to self-knowledge was self-reliance. For all that she engaged with 20th-century ideas, she was, in the deepest sense, a creature of her Edwardian upbringing. And by 1928, she knew that she had to strike out on her own. She was not alone in the desert when she went east. This fate would befall another of her characters, Joan Scudamore, in Absent in the Spring. But it was the first time that she had been thrown completely on her own resources. As a girl, solitude had been her secret delight, its pleasures enhanced by the sense of protection all around her. As a woman, she had sacrificed solitude to the demands of adult life. Now she did not know how she felt about it. It was necessary for her imagination. But the loneliness of the past 2 years had been so great. "I should find out now what kind of person I was," she wrote in her autobiography of her trip to Baghdad, "whether I had become entirely dependent on other people, as I feared. I could indulge my passion for seeing places, any place I wanted to see. I could change my mind at a moment's notice, just as I had done when I chose Baghdad instead of the West Indies. I would have no one to consider but myself. I would see how I liked that." She entered a different world in every sense. All at once, she was a grown woman of means sitting alone on the Orient Express, taking her pleasures as she chose. She threw off the hunted, haunted creature of London and lifted her eyes to the new things around her. The Cilician Gates, for example, which form the passage through the Taurus Mountains into Turkey and take the traveller from the Mediterranean into Anatolia. Alexander the Great and Paul of Tarsus had passed here, and now Agatha, at sunset, disembarked from her train and confronted this indescribable beauty. "I was so glad then that I had come, so full of thankfulness and joy." At the entrance to the east, she began to find her way back to her Christian God. in whom she had always believed, but had doubted of late. And something else. Later she described the Cilician gates as like standing on the rim of the world and looking down on the promised land, a land one will never reach. This was her most precious private dream, of the numinous, of the world that existed outside reality. She was back in the imagination of childhood, when she had dreamed a river at the end of the garden at Ashfield. The last thing she needed was the Englishwoman who shared her wagon-lit compartment on the Orient Express, and who instantly set herself to the task of directing Agatha's itinerary. "You can't possibly stay in a hotel in Baghdad. I tell you what you must do. You must come to us." Baghdad in those days was 30 years away from the revolution that would change Iraq forever. It was a city where the British traveller could find racing, tennis, clubs, and no doubt Marmite on toast. In the pre-war years, it was not at all unusual to find people of Agatha's class in such places. But Agatha was possessed with the spirit of adventure, not of colonialism. She had gone to the East to avoid her fellow countrymen, not to socialize with them. At the end of her magical journey, she found herself in what she called Memsahib land. I felt ashamed of myself for the caged feeling from which I suffered. To sit in Baghdad among the kind of people she had known all her life was not merely pointless, it was painfully retrograde. Here was the world she had inhabited before 1926, but with worse food and without Archie at her side. Everything had to be new and different. She would go away from this thin, bare, polite society to the city of Ur, below the confluence of the Tigris and the Euphrates, in what had once been the land of Sumer, where civilization had begun. Although, like a good Memsahib, she carried a letter of introduction to the Dig. As shown in her novel, The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha had been interested in antiquity for some years. She had visited anthropological museums on the Empire tour, and had written to her mother that looking at early human skulls was altogether one of the best afternoons I have ever spent. But archaeology became modish in the 1920s, and her interest was kept alive. It was in 1922 that Leonard Woolley began his work at Ur, for which he obtained a level of publicity rivaling that of Lord Carnarvon and Howard Carter, who had unearthed the tomb of Tutankhamun in Egypt. Woolley was a good journalist and a clever salesman, although his work was so fascinating that really it sold itself. "It is," wrote Woolley, "with the third dynasty of Ur that connected history begins." The excavations were from the late 3rd millennium BC. The kingdom of Ur fell in around 2000 BC and were of great importance. From Sumer, or southern Mesopotamia, had come the first recognized work of literature, the Epic of Gilgamesh, and the earliest concept of religion. The pyramid-like ziggurats, or temple towers, such as Woolley was excavating, were believed by the Sumerians to be homes to their gods. Agatha's knowledge of the Old Testament gave her some grasp of the mythical history of Mesopotamia. This was the land of the biblical patriarchs, of the 10 tribes of Israel that had been swept away by the Assyrians of the Babylonian Empire and its last king, Nebuchadnezzar. But Nebuchadnezzar, who had reigned in the 6th century BC, was absurdly recent in this context. Woolley's dig unearthed houses dating back to his time and, beneath them, to the time of Abraham. Agatha was mesmerized. It was the idea of history itself that gripped her, the fact that then could be now if one chose to make the connection. Again, this was a world away from Archie in every sense. As a young girl in Egypt, Agatha's attention had been on men rather than pyramids, but men were now out of the picture, and she exerted herself to engage with the life of the mind. Like many autodidacts, she wanted to carry on learning, but this was a decision that she took in the late 1920s, not to go under. Not to lose interest. I have been struck by the extraordinary number of things she did know, the sheer range of her experience, wrote A.L. Rowse. She was an honored guest at Ur. Woolley normally found visitors a terrible nuisance, but his wife Catherine was a fan of the murder of Roger Ackroyd, and that decided the matter. What Catherine wanted happened. Subsequently, Agatha would realize that this beautiful woman was also strange, controlling, and dangerous. But on her first visit, Catherine was extremely charming. It was a wonderful thing for Agatha to be known not as the troublesome hysteric of 1926, but as a writer, a celebrity, a person worthy of respect. Roger Ackroyd had, after all, been rather special. Catherine thought its creator a remarkable person. Although she quite obviously preferred the company of men, she took to Agatha and invited her to return to the dig. This, too, was a healing thing. What had half killed Agatha was the reality of how the world and Archie saw her, which was so different from how she saw herself. Now at Ur, she was viewed in a new way. It was unfamiliar. It still felt like a disguise, but she was quietly inclined to accept it. There may have been a hollow where her heart had been, but at least her life was interesting, in a way that it could never have been with Archie. He would not have thrilled to the sight of the Cilician gates, nor of black buffaloes watering on the road into Baghdad, nor of the colours of the desert, pale pink apricots and blues. He would not have eaten the strange food, greasy meat, leathery tomato omelettes, huge cauliflowers, without falling ill. He would have stood on the dig at Ur, watched a dagger slowly appearing with its gold glint through the sand, and thought of the golf he was missing at Sunningdale. So Agatha told herself, as she sought to remake her life, to collect experiences. It was a brave venture, for she was a wounded creature, damaged, hardened, and highly suspicious. If Dermot could be treacherous, then anyone could be treacherous. The world itself became unsure. I couldn't trust anyone or anything anymore. Yet for all her vulnerability, she had a latent strength. The men of her family, Frederick, Monty, were lovable and weak. The women could see life for what it was and bear it. Agatha was not innately of that type. She was a dreamer, a child. But she had studied these women, and with her artist's temperament, she was able to assume something of their character for herself. Things have to happen to all of us. That's the way life is. You just have to take it. Some of us can, some of us can't. So Agatha wrote, and the mirror cracked from side to side. And having been one of the people who couldn't take it, she thereafter remade herself into one of those who could. At the root of this shift was her writing. That was her refuge, her protection, her outlet, her real life. It was also increasingly successful. In 1928, a new contract with Collins gave her a £750 advance for her next 6 books, while an American contract with Dodd Mead gave $2,500. The Secret Adversary became the first of her books to be filmed in German, as was a story, The Coming of Mr. Quinn. A theatrical version of Roger Ackroyd was staged in 1928 as Alibi. This too would soon be filmed, with Charles Laughton, the first of several superb actors to be miscast as Poirot. Agatha enjoyed the novelty of Alibi, attending rehearsals with her dog Peter, but she was sufficiently irritated by the changes to the original to want to write a play of her own. Black Coffee would be produced in 1930. This, as A.L. Rowse later wrote, was the irony about the disappearance. Everybody thought it a publicity stunt, but it was genuine, so much better than the best of jobs. After that, every book was a bestseller, everything fell into her hands. The Big Four was one of the worst pieces of writing she ever published, but in the wake of 1926 it sold well, as did the other offerings of the 1920s. The Mystery of the Blue Train, The Seven Dials Mystery, and Partners in Crime. These last two are, respectively, a thriller and a series of short stories. It is easy to see that Agatha's real creative attention was on Giant's Bread, although Seven Dials has a dry wit that reveals a slightly acid state of mind. It has the same setting as The Secret of Chimneys, but comparing it with that wonderful, joyful book, shows, albeit obliquely, the road that Agatha had travelled in between. The country house, Chimneys, has been let by Lord Caterham to a rich businessman, Sir Oswald Coote, and these are the thoughts of Lord Caterham's daughter. She had a nightmare vision of England with innumerable Coots and innumerable counterparts of Chimneys, all, be it understood, with an entirely new system of plumbing installed. 100 delicate appreciations of life, which Lord Caterham could and did enjoy, were a sealed book to Sir Oswald. But Lord Caterham has all the pragmatism of his class and remains one of Agatha's finest creations. Coote got me in as a director of something or other. Very good business for me. Nothing to do except go down to the city once or twice a year and sit around a table where they have very nice new blotting paper. Then Coote or some clever Johnny makes a speech simply bristling with figures, but fortunately you needn't listen to it, and I can tell you, you often get a jolly good lunch out of it. Seven Dials is proof that Agatha could be very funny. A young man describes his new showgirl conquest as one of the 8 girls who made the living bridge, although this is hard to believe when reading The Ghastly Partners in Crime. Tommy and Tuppence are back, jollier than ever, enacting parodies of other detective writers in appallingly twee fashion. Back in 1929, these may have had a certain elan, but, as with many of Agatha's early short stories, they hold almost nothing of her essence. The murder at the vicarage, however, is all essence, all assurance. With the arrival of Miss Marple centre stage, she had appeared in a series of 6 short stories in 1927, later used in The 13th Problems, Agatha found the means to convey a complete world view. It was not quite her own view, although it has been seen as such, nor was it quite her own world, although she knew it very well. But it was her own creation, and if in real life she would have grown wildly irritated with her generic English village, in her imagination she lived there most happily. Among the hierarchies, the familiar roles, the morality that can be both petty and solid. St. Mary Mead, where Miss Marple lives, and where the murder at the vicarage is set, is the prototype. There are also Limstock in The Moving Finger, Chipping Cleghorn in A Murder is Announced, Witchwood under Ash in Murder is Easy, and Much Deeping in The Pale Horse. All of these are as defined and as real to the author as the world of Highbury was to Jane Austen. Real to the author may imply that Agatha's England is anything but real to anyone else. This criticism is often levelled, yet it is actually meaningless. Art does not reflect reality, it creates it. In that sense, the world of St. Mary Mead is real. It must be, else people would not believe in it as they do. It is said that the trick of Agatha's England is that it so lacks a proper sense of place, readers from anywhere can rewrite it in their heads, with a setting familiar to themselves. This is not quite true. Nobody who has read the accurate trot along the main street of Long Basing in Third Girl can complain of deficit of detail. Nor is it quite the point. Agatha was not a descriptive writer, but she could sketch an atmospheric setting by means so direct at times that it almost goes unnoticed. As for example, in And Then There Were None, when she took the brilliant step of staging mass murder in a bright-lit modern house with no atmosphere at all. She has, says P.D. James, the ability to conjure a world without actually describing it. Her villages are especially alive, and what is rarely appreciated is that they move with the times. A Murder is Announced, written in 1949, is full of post-war uncertainty. 15 years ago, one knew who everybody was. The Bantries in the big house, and the Hartnells, and the Price Ridleys, and the Weatherbys. While The Mirror Cracked from Side to Side opens with an unusually precise evocation of a 1960s housing estate. It was like a neat model built with child's bricks. It hardly seemed real to Miss Marple. But the village essence remains. The new world was the same as the old. The houses were different, the streets were called closes, the clothes were different, the voices were different, but the human beings were the same as they always had been. This is the reassuring wisdom of Miss Marple. to see past what is frightening and unfamiliar and find the sanity, the common bond, the truth. Miss Marple knows that there is a great deal of, well, queerness about. But she would have agreed, on the whole, with a remark Agatha made in 1955. Do you know, people always fall back on madness as an explanation when they don't understand a criminal's behaviour. What interested Miss Marple and her creator was the way in which behaviour relates to normality, even when it is murderous. Agatha was intrigued by the Croydon case because she saw in it a complex family puzzle, a recognisable pattern pushed to an extreme. Although in her 1929 article, she touched upon the idea that the murders had been committed because of a strange lust for killing, such a solution would not have interested her at all. Motive, for her, was everything. In The Moving Finger, Miss Marple realizes that the crime is not, as everybody else believes, motivated by something weird and impersonal. In fact, it is all too human. This book is perhaps Agatha's most wholly satisfactory, and was admired by clever friends like the epigraphist Sydney Smith, who called it Marple in her best vein. The setting is magnificently drawn, a Christie village in all its abundant life. Hearty Amy Griffith bounding unwanted up to front doors. "Hello, slackers!" organising the girl guides, while her heart burns for the local solicitor. The little aesthete Mr. Pye, whose voice rose to a falsetto squeak as he narrated the exciting circumstances under which he had brought his Italian bedstead home from Verona. The vicar's wife, Mrs. Dane Calthrop, with her lean greyhound face and her eccentric perceptiveness. Perhaps the setting comes across particularly well because it is narrated by an outsider, a London man who has something of Agatha's own detachment. "I have much business to transact," he says. "I shall call in at the baker's and complain about the current loaf." And later, when murder comes to the village, "Just for a moment I hated Limstock and its narrow boundaries and its gossiping, whispering women." This, too, Agatha could see. The danger in villages, the lack of outlets, the way inhabitants can turn in on themselves and fester. In Murder is Easy, the sinister undercurrent is made explicit. Again, the book is narrated by a male outsider who has returned from the East and finds himself initially sceptical, falling under the spell of a village whose comfortable face glints with danger. The sky was dull and menacing. The wind came in sudden erratic little puffs. It was as though he had stepped out of normal everyday life into that queer half-world of enchantment, the consciousness of which had enveloped him ever since he came to Witchwood. There is devilry in this village, sacrifices to Satan, a girl like a witch. But as always with Agatha's detective fiction, the real evil is all too human. The serial killer is a person whom life has thwarted, and who, in a village, has nothing to do but brood in it. Class also plays a convincing part in this book. Not because Agatha was an irredeemable snob, but because class did, still does, loom large in closed communities. Murder is Easy is not a Miss Marple, although it contains a substitute of sorts, but it is born of her world. Miss Marple herself was cast in the mould of Caroline Shepherd, the doctor's sister, in the murder of Roger Ackroyd. Miss Shepherd has a gift for unearthing information, usually from servants, and a terrific curiosity. Offered two separate snippets of gossip to pursue, she visibly wavers, much as a roulette ball might coyly hover between two numbers. But her deductive powers are wayward. Miss Marple tries far less hard because her innate wisdom is so much greater. In The Murder at the Vicarage, though, she is decidedly Carolinian. I must admit that her rapid appearance on the scene and eager curiosity repelled me slightly, says the vicar, who narrates the book. The later Miss Marple, who would never behave in such a way, which teeters upon the unladylike. Nor would she be described by the vicar's wife, Griselda, as that terrible Miss Marple, although the later emphasis upon her fluffiness is deceptive. As Books and Bookmen put it in an essay published after Agatha's death, Jane Marple is a tough old boot. If she was a nice old knitting lady, So was Madame Defarge.
Miss Marple shows her mettle early on in the murder at the vicarage. She is the only one of the elderly ladies congregating at the vicarage for tea and scandal to realize where the attentions of the local glamour boy are directed.
Not Lettice. Quite another person, I should have said.
She also reveals her creed, her way of looking at the world that makes her a natural detective. Griselda says that Miss Marple ought to be able to solve the case.
Like you did the time Miss Weatherby's gill of pickled shrimps disappeared, and all because it reminded you of something quite different about a sack of coals.
You're laughing, my dear, said Miss Marple, but after all, that is a very sound way of arriving at the truth. It's really what people call intuition and make such a fuss about. Now this, of course, was straight from Agatha's grandmothers. Like Miss Marple, both Margaret Miller and Marianne Beamer managed to hold a Christian faith in human nature with a realistic knowledge of its dire capabilities. Expect the worst, because the worst is so often true, but have belief, have faith, have compassion. That was the way of such women. Upright, wise, Victorian, infinitely consoling to Agatha. She was not yet 40, yet she took comfort in the creation of a woman who was far older, and whose relationship with life was serene, not disturbing, as her own had been. Miss Marple's emotional experience was almost non-existent, although her knowledge and understanding was immense, but it was a remove from life and happy to be so. Wisdom brought contentment. Agatha was wise in her books, less so in life. An exchange from the collection of short stories, The 13 Problems, shows the difference between Miss Marple and her creator. The character speaking is a painter, Joyce Lompriere. I am an artist. I see things that you don't. And then, too, as an artist, I have knocked about among all sorts and conditions of people. I know life as darling Miss Marple here cannot possibly know it.
I don't know about that, dear, said Miss Marple. Very painful and distressing things happen in villages sometimes. This was what Agatha liked, the distillation of life into a containable microcosm, such as St. Mary Mead, from which the answer to any problem could be deduced. She knew that it was, in a way, nonsense. She had lived through her own personal mystery story, and she knew none better that there are no true solutions, that reality always has an unfinished, untidy quality. At the same time, the world of her creation both fascinated and soothed her. Omniscience is the greatest gift that the fictional detective can offer to readers. What infinite reassurance there is in the idea of the brain that understands everything, that sheds light on every dark area. But this quality is a gift, too, for writers. Agatha found support in her detectives, in their omniscience and detachment, which showed itself differently in Poirot and Marple. It is frequently said that Agatha disliked Poirot, although there is no real evidence for this. In later life, she sought to protect him against misinterpretation as powerfully as if he were her own flesh and blood. But she had a deeper involvement with Miss Marple. Miss Jane Marple does not exist in the flesh and never has, she wrote. She is entirely a creation of the brain. But this was not entirely true. Post-1926, Agatha intensely disliked any implication that she wrote from life. Nevertheless, it was the reality of Miss Marple, her resemblance to those strong, wise, benign women of Agatha's childhood, that gave her creator the greatest succor. Agatha enjoyed Poirot, but she needed Miss Marple. She craved the sound of that quiet, ladylike voice. Like detective fiction itself, it was a bulwark against the mad and intrusive world beyond. A voice from the grave, from the Army and Navy stores, from Ashfield.